everybody. My name's Casey Crane. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Casey.
And I'm delighted to be here. And I want to thank all the appropriate people for my wife and I being here, Sherry and Diane, and our hosts, Jason and Brandy. And, you know, the guys that I got to play golf with while I was here, Rob and Tom and Jason and Chad, and got to meet some of the other golfers, Alan and Maury, and we had a wonderful time, you know, so far. And there's a little bit more to go. You've heard some of the best speakers on the planet the previous 4 days, and so I'm here to bayonet the survivors. And then, based on just the countdown of the states, I think you're ready to do some shouting and screaming tonight. So we'll see. I do want to mention that it occurred to me on my way here tonight that there are three people here tonight who were in the very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I walked into on November 28th, 1982, when I began this sobriety. And that's Marty S., Sharon C., and Charlie C. And, you know, I don't know what it means, except I've had some weird and wonderful examples to follow in my home group and everywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to AA, I heard people say that they had found a home in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not know what they were talking about. I had a home with parents and a brother and sister. I always thought of home as being those people. But I ran across a quote from Robert Frost who said that home is that place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. And that works for me. That means Alcoholics Anonymous is my home. And if the newer people that were here last night and the other nights are still here, I hope that you find a home in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you find a place where you can live and grow into the person that you were meant to be. And that means that the spiritual life is not a theory, you have to live it. We can show you how we did it. We can explain how we did it. We can't do it for you. And you probably already know that. You know, if I could tear it out of me and just hand it to you, I might do that. But you would miss the experience. And it's all about your own personal experience. God will intervene in your life. In fact, if you're here at all, he already has. So along the way, though, you'll get little glimpses of what's happening behind the obvious when those coincidences happen in your life that for which there is no rational explanation. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love what it's done for me and for the people that I care about most in the world. you know, I've been sober 26 and a half years, and, you know, after a while, I fit in so well in the normal world, I feel like I'm pretty normal. You know, I go to these meetings, and, you know, and I'm not needy and greedy like I was when I was new. I sponsor people. You know, a guy who I sponsors another fella who's in Wichita now, and there's a fella here from Wichita who told me that he's doing well there. He's going to be there for 3 weeks plus, and so, you know, we know people everywhere. My wife especially is a connector. You know, she can connect people anywhere on the planet. You know, if you're going to Timbuktu, she can find somebody there that's in the program, and you're going to be in safe hands when you get there. But every once in a while, something occurs that reminds me that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows, and that I'm going to have to keep going to these meetings, and I'm going to have to call my sponsor, and I'm going to need to focus on practicing the principles in all our affairs, all of my affairs. My wife and I were on a plane a couple Januaries ago. We were on our way to Jamestown, North Dakota in January. And when we said yes, it didn't occur to us. It's going to be a tad nippy there. So changed planes in Denver. We're on our way to Bismarck. The sun's going down behind us. You can see the orange glow in the sky. We're dozing a little bit, and then I see the lights of a city below us, and we go around, and I see the lights of this city again, and we're making our third lap around, and I nudged Sharon and said, you know, either we're getting the grand tour of Bismarck here, or there's something wrong with the plane. And just then the captain got on the horn and said, I don't want to alarm anybody, but... down on the ground, it's 55 below, and with the wind chill, it's 77 below, and up where we are, it's significantly colder than that. And as a consequence, the flaps are frozen in place. But not to worry. We practice this when we're learning how to fly, and I thought, yeah. What, a Cessna 30 years ago? I mean, and when's the last time you had a drink or a mind-affecting pill of any kind? But, you know, I kept that to myself. And he went on to say that we've been going around Bismarck so we can dump the fuel that we are not going to need. And when we land, we'll be coming in a little hotter than usual. So when you see the flashing lights of the crash vehicles... don't be alarmed. But he said the crash word, you know, and right then you could feel the whole plane just, you know, clutch up. And people started to whimper, and people were holding hands and starting to pray. And, you know, people thought, you know, this could be it. And we all thought that. And I turned to Sharon and said, honey, I just read a magazine article about how to survive the 10 worst-case scenarios, and one of them was a plane crash. We're in luck. So I thought, wow, what an opportunity. You know. So I trotted around the plane and grabbed those little cheater pillows and those little blankies they hand out and, you know, give me that blanket. You're not going to need that where you're going, buddy. And I piled them on top of my wife, and she looks so cute over there underneath it, with a little smile on her face. And the theory being, I suppose, that when you hit something going about 400 miles an hour, you'll be slightly buffered by this pile of pillows and blankets. Seems a little iffy, but... but we were told to really fasten our seat belts, and I thought, you know, the heck with this. You know, I'm going bareback in here. I'm going to, you know. And I mean, I was, you know, I got some kind of adrenaline rush that I hadn't had for many years. And we came zipping in, and people now are just sobbing. And we put it down really nice and smooth, but we're going way too fast. And, you know, we leave those old flashing crash vehicles in the, you know, way in the dust, and they burn out the brakes and hit the reverse thrusters, and the plane shudders to a stop. And I thought it. I guess I said it out loud because Sharon said, "Shh, honey." I said, "You call that a crash? That's not a crash. Let's go back up and do it again." And I mean, you know, part of this sharing stuff is you're going to get to know me in a way that my blood relatives will never understand, and we're already there. You know, if you get that, then you know me. You know, it's like you had a couple of drinks to that, and it's like if it's stupid and dangerous, not just stupid and not just dangerous, but if it's both, count me in. You know, let's go. It's gangbusters. Let's put it on the double yellow line and tear down the middle. And, you know, I'm sure that getting off that plane, I was the only person that was disappointed that I didn't see pieces of the plane breaking off and flaming wreckage. Now, I didn't really want to get hurt. I didn't want anybody else to really get hurt. And in a way, I was thinking of others. I was thinking about saving my wife. And but to me, it was... you know, the adrenaline took over, and under pressure, positive or negative, I think our character defects tend to come out in a way that is glaringly obvious to anyone who's seeing it. And so I'm going to need to keep coming to these meetings, you know. And I'm glad of it because, you know, as somebody stated the other day, imagine a life without this fellowship. Imagine a life where we don't have the love and support of so many people. And it's just like our little golf squad. You know, I when I went to the first tee on Wednesday, I knew one guy for 3 days. I had never met the other two guys. And by the seventh or eighth hole, we had a camaraderie, a joie de vivre going that you can't get anywhere else. And by the time we rolled into the 18th hole, we had done well. We didn't know if we won or lost. It really didn't matter. But we had that band of brothers feeling like we didn't want to leave. You know, let's go do something else together as four guys who know each other well. And this took place over a period of 4.5 hours, maybe. So I'm going to tell you my life story briefly as concerning alcohol. And, I love stories and I love the people that tell stories. And, I'm not a spiritual giant. I'm not going to tell you how to work the steps and I'm not going to point at you and I'm not going to, if you are new here, I suggest that you get a home group, get a sponsor, buy that book and read it, and do what is suggested in that book. Because what happens in that first 164 pages will change your life in every way worth talking about for the better. And that's the program. You know, what's happening here tonight is I'm going to tell you about alcoholism as it affected me and the people around me. And if any of it clicks, great. And if it doesn't, then go to another meeting or buy those CDs of the previous 4 days, and there's something there for you. I came from a good family. I was born in Huntington, New York, out on Long Island. I was the first of three children that my parents were going to have. My dad worked for Republic Aviation during World War II and helped design and build the Thunderbolt that helped win the war in Europe, and a pusher prop plane called the Seabee. His career progressed. We moved to upstate New York, then western Pennsylvania, to a steel town where I went to junior high and high school. And when I graduated from high school, I went off to Penn State where I went to college. That's the brief version. What happened on the inside was I was a perfectly normal and well-adapted kid until 2 weeks before my eighth birthday. I remember exactly when and why this was, because that's when I was diagnosed with polio. This is right before the Salk vaccine was synthesized by Jonas Salk. There was no cure for it. A lot of kids that got that. In fact, half the people that ever got polio in this country during those years died of polio. Obviously, I can walk, and I'm very lucky. But for 9 months, I couldn't. And I was in a hospital. Nurses came into my room with boiling hot rags in a washing machine with insulated gloves, and they put them all over me. And I twice a day to loosen up the muscles. And they did, and twice a day I tried not to cry. I don't know why I thought that was important, but twice a day I failed and I cried because it was incredibly painful. They put it all over you except right where your eyes are. And and I was isolated from other children. When I was in the polio ward, other kids were brought in. They were put in iron lungs, and some were fitted with the leg braces. Some didn't survive, and but for 9 months, I was not allowed to be around any other children whatsoever. My younger brother and sister weren't allowed to be in the same room with me. And during that period of time, I changed. I changed from a fairly normal kid, I suppose, to a socially isolating person. I learned how to be by myself, and entertain myself and read and paint and listen to the radio. My parents were book readers. We didn't have TV for another few years. So I became an odd duck, you know. But we lived in a big house in upstate New York at this time, 12-room house with a fireplace in every room. It was, you know, colossal. It was made into a hotel later. And I had the run of that house. I never had a wheelchair. I was carried from one place to another. You know, I didn't run away from home because I didn't know where I would go, but I started living in a world of books. And I trained myself to read very quickly, and I could speed read. You know, you don't have anything else to do, may as well learn how to read fast, and I did. And from the time I was 10 until I was 17, I read at least one book every day, cover to cover, that wasn't a school book, and I wrote down what that book was in a little, you know, like a little executive planner for a little kid. And but when I went back to school, I was shunned and treated as an outcast, it seemed to me, by the other kids, and I thought, the hell with you, I never needed you in the first place, and I set out to be a loner, weirdo, outlaw, geek, and succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. I overdid it, but I started dressing differently than the other kids. I didn't want to be a child anymore. I wanted to be a grown-up, and in fact, I didn't want to just be a grown-up. I wanted to be an old man. So I'd go to the old man section of department stores and buy clothes there, and my mother would just shake her head, and even the salespeople tried to talk me out of it. But I was wearing pleated pants with cuffs when, you know, when I was 9 years old. Yes, I am quite a bit older. I'm quite a bit older than I appear to be. Just short for my age. Anyway. But school was easy because I was a book reader, and by the time I was ready to go off to college, I was captain of 3 varsity sports because I was grotesquely competitive. I was a crippled kid who wound up being captain of the track team. And I never told anybody about it. It was my little secret. And I thought, you know, you can do anything with willpower. You can do anything with obsession. You know, and my way of getting good was we'd go out on Long Island in the summertime, and I would run at sunrise, and I would run into the sun on the hard-packed sand, and then I would run away from the sun and see that my big toes were in an exact straight line, because the shortest distance between 2 points was a straight line. That's obsession. I bought, you know, World War II combat boots and ran the sand dunes because I had heard some Australian runner was doing that. And, you know, this didn't leave a lot of time for people. I didn't like people, you know. I don't know where I got that, but, you know, somewhere in there I felt like I was a different species, you know, in the wrong place in the wrong time. Off to Penn State, really needed a drink. Years before, somebody handed me a Schaefer's of Philadelphia, the beer to have if you're having more than one, was their jingle back in those days. And Schaefer's. Remember the important things, right? And I drank 2 cans of Schaefer beer. I got bombed on 2 cans because I was in amazing physical condition. I had a low heart rate and low blood pressure. I could run all day long, and it knocked me out. And I went back to my dorm room, and I passed out. And when I woke up, I realized if I was ever going to fit into this world at all, I was going to have to learn how to drink. And I don't know where that thought came from, but I got into training for drinking, just like anything else. You know, I went to frat parties and mixers and drank that 3-2 beer. And at first, I couldn't handle it. But after a couple months, I wasn't throwing up on myself or my dates. All of a sudden, I had a social life, and alcohol had done it. You know, alcohol was going to get a lot of credit for anything good that happened in my life for the next 21-plus years. It took me a while to gear up to it, but eventually I became a daily drinker. And my life started to change in ways that were, in retrospect, were obvious, but at the time were subtle. And, you know, one day in cross-country practice at Penn State, we ran miles for time. And I had just turned 18 years old, and I ran a mile in 4 minutes and 7 seconds. That was quick for a kid that age at that time. And one of the assistant coaches came to me the next day, and he had his clipboard, and he said, "Casey, at the rate you're going, the rate you've been progressing, you will inevitably break the four-minute mile within the next year, maybe by next spring. We're going to get you a full-ride scholarship. Keep up the good work. Attaboy." And I remember exactly what I thought when he told me that. And I thought, he knows I can do it. I know I can do it. Everybody I run against knows I can do it. I don't have to do it. I'm done. And at the end of that season, I never ran competitively again, because for me, it was already done. Why waste my time running around in circles so I can be a footnote in an athletic history book when, after all, practice coincided with happy hour at the Rathskeller? Bring a sorority girl, drink for free. What do I need with this running around stuff? And, you know, the once bright guy was disappointed in college. You know, it wasn't Oxford and mortar boards. It was high school with ashtrays. And, you know, not my cup of tea. And I thought, the heck with this. And I quit going to class. And I was hanging out at the Rathskeller with, you know, with my new sorority chicks. And, you know, life was good. Who needed all this other stuff? And so they kicked me out. And right before they kicked me out, I left under my own power. You know, "You can't fire me, I quit" is one of our theme songs. And and I bounced around a little bit, and I worked in a steel mill for a while, and I thought, workers of the world unite, we got to get out of here. And went off to Youngstown University. My check cleared, and so I got in. They didn't want to see test scores or any of that, and now I'm in Youngstown, Ohio, which at that time was known as Bombtown or Little Chicago, which had nothing to do with me when I got there. But again, I was there a short period of time, and somebody handed me a stick of boo or reefer, that nasty felonious devil weed, and I smoked that stuff. And the next day when I woke up, I didn't have that much of a hangover. I had kind of, my cheeks were sore from cramping up from laughing so hard the night before. And I'm loyal to the things I like, so I probably smoked it for the next decade, but no big deal. The main course was still alcohol, because I'm an alcoholic, and nothing was ever going to push alcohol out of the way. And certainly not to belabor the point, but all of the things that were available in the 60s, I did the way an alcoholic would. If one of these babies will put you on the moon, let's try 8 or 12 or 20. Let's see just how far we can push that envelope. And I ran into like-minded people. You know, my life again started to change. I got rid of all my Ivy League clothes. I got a nice leather jacket. My hair started to sprout down to my shoulders, and a different thing was happening. I was drinking Cutty Sark because I'd saved my steel mill money now, and I'm no more 3-2 beer, and I like scotch, and I'm hanging out at these funky dives on the north side of Youngstown and loving it. But people are starting to notice that there's something funny about the way that I drink. There's something wrong about the way that I drink. And even people that are out there. There's a friend of mine with a $200 a day heroin habit that even the other bikers wouldn't talk to came up to me one day and he said, "Casey, your friends and I, we've been talking. They elected me to come talk to you. We're worried about you, man. You know, you're an alkie. You're a juicer." And I said, "No, wait a minute, Stoney. What is it? What is it you're recommending here? I start running that white powder like you are, and you're what, a 2-time loser? What's the benefit here? You know, I'm happy now. I got my Pabst Blue Ribbon and a handful of pep pills, and, you know, this is good." And he said, "I knew this would be a waste of time." And he said, "I got to tell you, though, you're going to ruin your liver. You know, you're going to grow up to be like our parents." And I thought, that's not all bad. What's wrong with that? You know, around this time, I probably knew about 50 chicks named Sunshine. One of them was the Youngstown Sunshine was my girlfriend. She came up to me and said, you know, at the rate you're going, you're going to be dead pretty soon. And when you do die, I'm going to have you cremated and sell your ashes for $50 a spoon because, frankly, you're worth more dead than alive. And and I took it as kind of a backhanded compliment because 50 was a lot for anything. And you know, the point is that even people that are out there, people that are hanging out over the edge too, they don't work in the field. These aren't social workers or something. These are people that are noticing that there's something wrong with the way that Casey drinks, and they've got to tell him before they cut him loose altogether. And for me, it was the opposite situation. It was, you know, they're excommunicated from my world. They're excommunicated from my life. So I piled a bunch of people in a car, and we headed for the left coast, and we bumped into the Pacific Ocean, and remembered that our good buddy Mad Dog lived over there on North Vermont Avenue, so now four people are living in Mad Dog's one-room place. But who cares, because we're hardly ever there. Anyway, we're down at the rain check room and Barney's and the whiskey and all of those funky dives in that part of the world. And I was there in the late 60s and early 70s, and a lot of your famous dead rock and roll stars were still ambulatory, and some of them were friends and acquaintances of mine, and the message was in the music, and I have no musical talent whatsoever and never did, but I loved being around it, and I had the contraband that would allow me to be a part of all of that, life was going just swimmingly until my good friend got stabbed in the heart by his hooker girlfriend, Mad Dog, whose apartment it was, and his family came and got him out of there, and it's the first time I saw somebody that I cared about get stabbed, but it wasn't the last time, and it was also the first time that even I noticed that the milk of human kindness was beginning to run a little thin in my veins, because I thought, if you can't take a little steak knife in the chest, maybe you better bow out of this fast-paced life we're in here. The overly sensitive youth is now hard-hearted and is thinking about God knows what, but I'm not thinking about my friends, probably the best friend I had in my life for many years. Eventually he moved up to the side of Mount Hood and wouldn't come down because society was mean to him. I moved in with the Stabber's two best girlfriends, and we had a beautiful Spanish-style home just off the Sunset Strip. No visible means of support whatsoever. Semi-pro means that sometimes they remembered to charge at parties and sometimes they forgot, and I was there like a living reminder. Now, I'm the same person that tried to memorize the Baltimore Catechism when I was a kid, and now what am I? You know, who am I? But I think I had it all figured out. And at the time, I was reading the kind of books that psychiatrists read, and I was reading philosophy, and I was bending it all to suit my needs, because it really was. When we get up in the morning, what does Casey and his band of snaggletooth crazies want to do next? This had to come to an end at some point. A friend of mine who came from back east and figured out where I was living and knocked on the door and said, "Man, we gotta get you out of here. Who are all these people in your living room? It looks like rejects from the Manson family," which was current events at the time. And I said, "Don't insult these people, Dennis. These are my patients. They call me doctor, and I'm helping guide them through life." He said, "Oh, now I get it." "Yeah, you're a regular Albert Schweitzer among the natives here, huh? You know, you're bringing culture." He said, "Listen, you're playing God with these people's lives. You're killing yourself, and you're killing these people. And anyway, I got a better idea. If we go up north and join the Merchant Marine, we can smuggle jewels and drugs from the South Sea Islands and retire to Costa Rica and live like kings. What do you think?" And I said, "You know, that is a better idea. Who are these people?" So we jetted out of town and went up to San Francisco and Portland and Seattle and tried to join the Merchant Marine and couldn't get in. You know, you got to... got to picture what these three people looked like. I mean, you know, my hair was dark then, yes, but I weigh around 180. I weighed 50 pounds less at the time, 130. I had hair down to here. My eyes are going around like this. And I hadn't been out in the sun in several years and did not look like an able-bodied seaman. I looked like a guy with a plan, you know, and they were filled up with guys with plans. And so went back and lived in the streets of San Francisco. My days as a Little League big shot are over. I'm eating at the Mission. I'm living in a $20 a week hotel, and now things get bad, and I moved to a $12 a week hotel. Being a book reader, I thought it was ironic. It was called Finnegan's Hotel, and I thought, Finnegan's Wake, you know. Anyway, the door had been kicked down so many times, there was no point in even closing it anymore. Communal bathroom where the junkies are having a party. And I thought, how did I get here? You know, what? This doesn't make any sense. So we left, and by now we're down to two people instead of three, and I head back east, and I wind up living in an abandoned train station in Chicago, the old LaSalle Street Station. It was closed then. The building still exists, and I was there with Sharon a couple of years ago, and it was a very powerful experience to see the old homestead again. You know, I was a penniless alcoholic. Now I'm drinking screw-top wine, preferably red ripple wine, not that crummy pagan pink or that that pear stuff, whatever the hell that was. And Mad Dog would do, or Richard's Wild Irish Rose, but it had to be that screw-top wine, that 99 cent a bottle or whatever it was. And I remember my state of mind was so strange. I remember once standing on an overpass over the Dan Ryan Expressway in a driving rain. I couldn't have been wetter if I fell off a boat. And I'm thinking, look at those fools down there on their way to God knows where, those foolish ratlanders. They don't know what it's like to be truly free like I am. You know, nobody expects me anywhere. In fact, nobody with my last name even knows where I am, and they haven't known in a long time because I know they wouldn't approve. It was at the bottom? No. I had to go back to Youngstown where I'd been somebody once, somebody with potential and promise, and published poet in Youngstown. I could ride that for a while, and ran out of money, and I had a... I had a buck to my name one day, and I went to the liquor store and package store and bought a bottle of Ripple for 79 cents, still had 21 cents left, and went back to the crash pad where I was staying and realized that I needed more than just a quart of wine, and I was going to have to try to intensify the effect if I possibly could. So I found a syringe laying around, and I drew up 2 cc's of red Ripple wine and fired it into my arm because... As my first sponsor said, apparently you're not a social drinker, Casey. and I never told anybody about that. But it was in my my first inventory. I've done two. I did in that first inventory, I told my sponsor that I had injected wine into my veins and that I was swearing him to secrecy. I didn't care if he blabbed anything else about me, but I was ashamed of it, and I felt guilty about it. And he said, I bet you, you know, if you thought it might help somebody else, you might tell that story someday, and I have told that story. The first time I mentioned it, I was participating at the Key Group in Culver City, and I had about 3 years, I guess, and a guy came up to me and shook my hand, and I was embarrassed and ashamed that I'd even brought it up. And he came up to me, and he had a mohawk. He was taller than me, like a blonde mohawk. His eyes were doing this. He said, man, I shot 151 rum. What do you think of that? I said, you are a crispy critter, dude. There is something wrong with you. And he said, I'll tell you what, though, I've never told another living human being about it until right now. And I said, now there's two of us. So, you know what? In the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we are free from the chains of the past that bind us to those foolish secrets, those things that we think we're the Lone Ranger on, the guilty and shameful things of the past that can drag us back into the world of alcohol, of active alcoholism. And if you're carrying anything around, inventory it and get rid of it, you know. Tell somebody, you know, get that triangulation going between you and your sponsor and a higher power. And in that, it is diffused and it will go away. The pain of it will go away. And because everybody that is here that has ever gotten the gift of sobriety deserves to have the fullness of that gift. And if you leave and get bombed again, there's nothing good in that. You know, you don't have to have a slip. I had a little further on to go. I came back to California, got arrested 3 times in 5 weeks for drunk driving. They took away my driver's license in Santa Monica at the time. You had to have a license to ride a bicycle. I got a bicycle, and they stopped me at 3 a.m. One night I'd been kicked out of a party at gunpoint. I know when to leave. It's when the .38 is aimed at my forehead and the hammer is cocked, and I said, okay, I can take a hint. And so I'm going a little fast at 3 a.m., jacked up on vodka and that stuff that keeps you awake. And they pulled me over, and I gave them a fake name, and I knew that they were going to figure out who I was. And so they left me with this, like, rookie cop with a German Shepherd in the back, and so I'm looking at the German Shepherd, and I'm looking at this cop with his attempted mustache, and I thought, you know, I got to figure out how to get out of this. They're going to find out any minute that there's a couple warrants out for this knucklehead me. And so I remember reading this James Bond book once about how the Doberman was coming at our hero, and he jumps at him, and, you know, our hero grabs the leading paws and flips over backwards and wins the fight with the dog. And I thought, aha. So I say to the police officer, listen, why don't you turn fuzzy on me over here, and if I beat the dog in a fair fight, you turn me loose. And, well, he says, we got a live one here. We got send everybody. They even sent the fingerprint truck. And so anyway, they took away my bicycle and my... Now they couldn't get my shoes off, you know, or my feet off. So now I'm getting arrested for drunk walking and drunk... I fell asleep on somebody's lawn one night. It was too far to get home, and that dewy grass felt so good on the side of my fevered brow, you know. So I laid there, and, you know, it's dark out. You know, no one's going to notice, but of course... Then the old sun comes up and that giant bright light is on, and apparently somebody opened up the drapes and looks out and said, oh dear, there's a lump in the lawn. Call the police. And so the first I'm aware of this, I hear the tires squeal into the curb, and Officer Bird, who has arrested me before, gets out of the car and sees me as I get up like that. Says, oh, look, it's Casey. Casey, you know the drill. Get in the car. We're going to have to cuff you and stuff you one more time. And I thought, you know, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of getting arrested, drunk tanks, judges, lawyers. You know, I was a track star. I'm not taking this anymore. And I take off, you know. You don't run too good when you've been passed out in the lawn, you know, but... Still, I'm faster than these guys with all of their tools on their belt. But that opening in the hedge that I saw kind of closed up when I got there. So now I'm stuck. You know, the hedge is like climbing inside my jacket. And Officer Bird was on to me. They're laughing so hard they can barely get the cuffs on. He says, look at this, the master criminal captured by vegetation. And that was... I'm a sensitive guy, you know, that hurt my feelings. And So that, you know, that was it. They sent me to Camarillo State Hospital, the Nut House, and spent 10 weeks there and got well. When I came out, I started going to meetings with guys that I met there. AA sent panels into the Nut House. I loved going to meetings with my friends. They were real enthusiastic about AA, and my big book is signed by my friends from the Nut House, and we had formed a, there used to be a thing called the Alcoholic Olympics, and we formed a relay team of burned out jocks who had been in the Nut House, you know, and we were going to represent Camarillo State Hospital. So the staff made this banner about 8 feet long, a white banner with big red letters that said Camarillo on it, and we used to wrap it around, the four of us, and go into 26 and Broadway and Ohio Street with that banner around us. And, you know, people sent somebody over to work with the new people from the insane asylum, and we were warmly welcomed, and that's where my big book came from. But, you know, I had a little further to go, and during that period of time, I went through 14 detoxes and 5 live-in rehabilitation centers because I'm so smart and I get things right away. And no, it's because I was not going to give up alcohol no matter what. And alcohol meant too much to me. It meant more than even I understood. And I was emotionally, psychologically, and physically addicted to alcohol, and I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. So on my way into my last detox, something happened to me that needed to happen. I finished off the last of a little bit of vodka that was left in this bottle, and I walked into the detox. And on my way walking in, it's like the sky opened up in an odd way. The sky was still there, but I knew that I was going to die drunk, and there was nothing anybody could do about it, including me. And my ability to control and manipulate everything and everybody was gone. And it wouldn't make any difference if all of that was gone. I was going to die drunk, end of story, no matter what happened in there. And I'd been court-ordered to maybe 150 AA meetings. I'd heard some of the most brilliant communicators talk about alcoholism that have ever lived, and Chuck C. and Clancy and on and on. And the magic words didn't do the magic trick for me, but this did, because I was surrendered to the fact that I was going to die drunk and that I was going to have to do what everybody else on the planet did that wanted to live sober. And so when I came out of that and came back into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, where some people recognized me from before, I was warmly welcomed. And people could see right away that I was surrendered. There was something different about the way that I looked, and I didn't look smug, and I wasn't a smart aleck as much as I had been before. And people suggested I get a sponsor. And so I got phone numbers and business cards. I spread them out on the floor, and I was living with a waitress at the time, so I had a place to live, and a functioning alcoholic, a girlfriend with a job. And I saw one guy was a planner for the Mattel Corporation, that little toy company that makes the Barbie doll and the Malibu Ken. And if I asked this guy to be my sponsor, I could manipulate him into being a planner, making a Crazy Casey doll, being a veteran with a diploma from the Nut House, and I would be immortalized in plastic, and when I die in a few months while drinking, I would live on forever in this little life. And that was my reason for asking him to be my sponsor. I mean, these newcomer ideas are really, they're a real treat, and I had a plan. But I did the next indicated right thing. Apparently motives don't count as long as you do the next indicated right thing, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he had 13 months more than I had, and that made sense to me. 13 years was crazy, and but 13 months, I could get my mind around that. And he was a four-eyed carrot top who was real enthusiastic. He was welcoming newcomers, and he was going to 6 or 7 meetings a week, and he was exactly what I needed because he was willing to sponsor me and all the other zanies that asked him. And I was willing to do what he asked me to do, and I don't exactly know why. maybe because I had the opportunity to make the choice of choosing him. And because I'd chosen him, it gave him the power to suggest what I should do next. And he asked me if I could take direction, and I said, yeah. And he said, I want you to develop a habit of prayer. And in order for it to be a habit, you have to do it every day. So I want you to say thank you in the morning. I want you to say please in the morning, and I want you to say thank you in the evening. Thank you for keeping me sober. And in the morning, please keep me sober for this day. And I said, you don't understand. You know, the God of my understanding is an all-powerful lunatic who can hurl you into a lake of liquid fire for having a bologna sandwich on the wrong day of the week. I'm not going to send up some little lame-o out of practice prayer and tip my hand to where I might be. And he said, whoa, wow. Ooh. He said, we don't believe in the God you don't believe in either. And he lost me on that one, so I said, you know, I may look dumb, Keith, but, you know, that's gobbledygook. What does that mean? And he said, what it means is that you can pray to something that is stronger and bigger than you. You can pray to the fact that we believe in a God here in Alcoholics Anonymous that is individually different. You can pray to the idea of this as your home group, etc., but I want you to start tonight. And so I did, and I prayed to a doorknob, like one of the suggestions, and felt like an idiot. So I'm walking on the beach the next day, and being unemployed and unemployable, apparently. And I ran up to him at Ohio Street that night, and I said, Keith, I got it, I got it, I got it. It's the ocean, man. Call your ocean man, or call your sponsor man or dude. They love that. Anyway, he said, okay, keep it brief, 25 words or less. I know you. And I said, okay, it's the ocean. You know, it's controlled by the moon. It's got the tides. It goes in and out. It covers 3/4 of the earth. It's really big, man. And underneath, the big ones are eating the little ones. It's a vicious fight for survival, and I understand that. And he said, okay. Calm down. And he said, okay, pray to the ocean if you have to. And if you got to have pictures of sharp-toothed fish in your head while you do that, knock yourself out, you newcomer knucklehead, but just pray. And so I'd say for 3.5 years or so, I prayed to the ocean. It was something tangible. I could go down to the ocean. I could talk to the ocean. I could have a few words with the ocean as a higher power in the morning and in the evening. And as a consequence, I developed a habit of prayer. And the first time I heard the famous Dallas resident Jimmy Williams talk, he talked about a higher power coming into a par. Into his car, a God that he had never known coming into the car with him as he was driving the loop around, I guess, Dallas. And I mean, I got chills unbelievable because I was driving on the 10 freeway before I ever heard this, going downtown to my office. I had a new car and I was wearing a new suit and I was 3.5 years sober, and that same God that I had never known was there with me, the God that I'd been talking to every morning and every night and sometimes in between for 3.5 years. And it was a tangible God of love and compassion who looked out for fools and drunks like me, whether I was tuned into it or not. And apparently I was beginning to tune in enough to start to get it. And you know, my sponsor had some other ideas for me, like, you know, get commitments at all the meetings. A lot of people call it a service position, and my service position for several years was sweeping up cigarette butts outside meetings in the dark, because I could do it. You know, I was really badly damaged by alcohol, and I couldn't talk. I was very shaky about all of that, and I had 60 days, and I could say, my name is Casey, and I'm an alcoholic. But my mind was racing so fast. The only way I can explain it was like an engine with a broken flywheel, and the thoughts would go faster and faster, and my speech couldn't keep up with it. And I complained to my sponsor once about that, and he said, you know, maybe you're just going to have to accept the fact that you're always going to be like that. I thought, that's not the answer. You know, that's not, I don't want to hear that. And he said, you may always be that way. You know, get used to it. You've got 2 months under your belt, and you are like that. So that's it. I thought, man, hard-hearted sponsorship, boy. But I walked away, and I thought, I'll show him. I'll be like that forever. You know, I am not only accepting it, I am welcoming the fact that I am one shaky SOB, and that's the way it's going to be. I started to get better right then. And that's the power of acceptance. You know, I told you I was a voracious book reader, and I was. I couldn't read anymore. I got out that big book, boy, I'll tell you. You know, when you're new, read that big book, half a page, better than second, I'll boom, put you right out. Wow. What are they talking about? I thought, you know, I'm English lit major, you know, 6 years in college, 2 years worth of credits, but, you know, still cocky. And I thought, this stultifying turn of the century style, I thought varieties of religious experience was a plow through, but this is. Because it wasn't speaking directly to me, you know. It wasn't speaking directly to me. I was looking at it like it was a textbook that I had to memorize and that I was going to be tested on, and I was just looking at it wrong. So what I did to train myself to read again is I got the sports page of the LA Times, and I got the front page of the sports page, and I went to the upper left-hand corner, and I read the first sentence, and I turned away. And I couldn't remember what I just read, so I read it again. And until I could remember the content of the first sentence, I wouldn't go on to the second sentence. Now, this is where my brand of obsession actually worked for me, you know. I heard somebody when I was new say, if you still have character defects, you're just not using them right. And I thought, I didn't get it, but I understand it now. And the After a while, about half an hour, I could read that whole first paragraph and look away, and I could tell myself what was in that first paragraph. And I spent 8 hours one day, with a little lunch break, reading the front page of the sports page of the LA Times. And it was by doing that that I trained myself how to read again, and read and understand what it was that I was reading. Of course, I understood the words, and I understand the English language, but again, my mind was interfering with it. You know, my brain power, whatever that is, you know, that chaos, that space junk noise that was happening in my head. And my sponsor was really on my side in ways that I could barely understand. I told him that I had had grand mal seizures while I was tying my shoes, and that I didn't know how to get over my fear of shoelaces, and I was afraid to tell anybody about it, you know. I said, you know, standing around coffee tonight, nobody was talking about how they're afraid of their shoelaces, but I was feeling that fear, and what should I do? He said, have you thought of loafers? And I mean, as silly as an example as that is, and admittedly, it's silly, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's a problem right here in front of you. In my case, it was shoelaces. So you forget about the problem. You do an end run around the problem and come live in the solution of loafers over here. The hell with the problem. Skip through the problem. Let's come live in the solution. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just thought the guy was a genius, you know. Where does he get this stuff? This is fantastic. Yeah. He wanted me to get a job. I said, you know, I know you're not going to like to hear this, Keith, but, you know, working's for chumps. You know, when you're like this, you know, there's a rare breed of people that are that live off the fat of the land. You know, we take advantage of the chumps and the marks of the world, and he said, hold it. He says, you're going to be self-supporting through your own contribution, you con man, and quit acting like a criminal and talking like a criminal. You're going to be self-supporting through your own contributions. Get a job. And I went over to this gas station where I used to use a hot shell credit card to buy gas and asked him if I could sweep up at the gas station, and they just looked at me funny. They wouldn't even say yes or no. It's like, leave. I got a job tarring a roof. That ended. I got a job painting hallways, a guy in AA rehabbed apartment buildings. So I got a job painting hallways in an apartment building. I was on the third floor. I had a can of paint. I had a paint roller. I had a brush. I had a ladder, a paint pan. And after 3 days, he had to let me go because I couldn't apply paint to a wall in an orderly fashion. I'd have six layers here and none over here because space junk roaring around in my head. The prognosis was not good, and I could see that he was sad to let me go from a $5 an hour job, which, you know, was a good thing for me because I was, he knew my real name and was willing to give me a chance. But I was 10, 11 months sober, and a couple guys in my home group came up to me and said, we work for a sales organization. We know you're full of the old blarney, and we'll set up an interview with our sales manager. Why don't you come in and bring your resume? I typed up this brutally honest resume. The front page is education and experience. Page two is all the psych wards and detoxes I'd been in, and it was quite a laundry list. Kept me from getting good health insurance for years. And I went in and I tossed it on this guy's desk, and I said, don't read page two. It's a history of alcohol and drug abuse. I'm here to sell you me. I can sell anything to anybody. I can sell toxic chemicals to people that ought to know better. And I'm your guy. And he said, wow. He said, guys like you, you got more balls than brains. You're exactly what we're looking for. There's your desk. Go get them, tiger. I started selling a real thing to real people with checkbooks that didn't have to go steal the money. And I thought, wow, where has this been? And I was using my real name, real Social Security number, and little red flags were starting to pop up in places. And I called the IRS one day, and they said, aha, there you are. We've been looking for you. We have a little thing called interest and penalties you've skipped out on for many years now, and here's a big number for you to digest. And I worked out a payment plan with the IRS and started feeling a little more like a human being, or at least some kind of citizen. I thought, I wonder how long this will last. I called up the National Student Loan people. They had lent me a lot of money to go to college, and I had defaulted on that since 67. They have interest and penalties over there too, but now I'm making money hand over fist, and luckily I could write them a check. And as Clint H. of my home group used to say, if you want to make a lot of money, start making your amends. You're going to need it, you know. And for the most part, they don't want your money, they want their money back. Wow, what a concept. So my life started to change, and I'll just tell you briefly, throughout the 80s I did sales. I wound up by 88 and 89 being marketing director for an electronics company. I'm going to preface this by saying it has no relevance on sobriety whatsoever what you do for a living, and I'm just telling you what happened to me. I couldn't take it. I had company plastic. I had a salary. I had a commission. I had overrides on commissions of 13 people that worked for me. I knew all about this product. I could have cared less about it. I wasn't getting to play golf enough. I had started to play golf again, a game that my father gave to me many years before. And I hadn't played in over 20 years. So I've been sober long enough, or almost 8 years, that I wasn't afraid to just walk away. And I found a guy who said, do you know how to write a proposal? Can you write a company prospectus? I was writing two or three proposals a day when I was the marketing director. And I said, yeah, I can do that. And he said, I have a golf product. It's new. I need to have some proposals written, and I need a company prospectus. We're going to present it to this bigger company that you'd recognize the name. And so for a salary, I went to work for this company that we traveled all over and analyzed golf courses, and I got paid to do it. And I got paid to play golf. And it was big fun, I'll tell you. Then the USGA declared this product violated the rules of advice. I think it's 14-3 in the rules of golf. So adios to that. And one of the things I sold in the 80s was guard service. A guy said, would you like to go to work guarding a swimming pool with a 45? I said, no thanks. I'm living on my credit cards now. He asked me 6 months later, would I like to be a chase car driver for the King of Saudi Arabia's favorite daughter? I said, what does it pay? And he told me, and I said, okay, what do I do? And he said, show up at such and such a place tomorrow. He introduced me to the chief hostage negotiator for SWAT, me, the master criminal kept by vegetation. Now I acquired some actual skills. I didn't know they were marketable. I know how to slide a Lincoln sideways at 80 miles an hour and come back the other way without hurting the parked cars. And so now I'm driving this guy named Dave around with a Glock in his lap, and we're tailgating this Maserati. So I did that for a while, and went to work for the studios as a non-union driver. I thought, if I'm going to do this, I may as well be a union driver. And I did, and I joined the Teamsters Studio Drivers Union, the highest paid drivers in the world. You won't hear that from most microphones. If you're paying $14 to go to the movies, you know why. Anyway, and I would work six or eight months and play golf the rest of the time, because for me, I was chasing the dream that when I was sitting around those opium dens wondering how good I could be at golf, I got a chance to find out. And I got to qualify five times and four and play in the state championship of the state of California as a senior. And I knew my dad would be happy. You know, I was doing it for him. My father passed away in 1998, and a couple of months before he did, after years of talking to him on Sundays on the phone after the golf tournaments would end, because I knew then we would have a basis for talking about something other than him just ranting and raving at me. He lived 3,000 miles away. But I wanted to make amends to my father, which I did, and I wanted to establish a relationship with my dad. And I did that. And we found a basis for common ground, and then we were able to talk like father and son. And a couple of months before he passed away, he said, you know, you're probably my best friend in the whole world. And that's a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous. People talk about practicing these principles in all their affairs. One of the principles is perseverance, and another is love. And I love my dad, and I wasn't going to let it go if I could possibly get a hold of him. And I was current with him when he left this world. With my mother, it was a little trickier. She had died in 1980. The last, as she lay dying, I breathed cheap vodka on her. I was hot out of a 90-day treatment thing. And she died without ever seeing her oldest child be sober. And I used to tell her, 2 out of 3 isn't bad, Mom. So, you know, don't worry about me. I'll be okay. But when I got sober, I needed to make amends to her in the worst way. And my sponsor got it from an old-timer in my group, who that same Clint H. that I mentioned before, who got it from the Al-Anons in Billings, Montana, I believe. And I wrote a letter to my mother as if it was conversational, as if I was actually talking to her, and I had my sponsor look at it and edit it. And And I took it to her gravesite along with a pail, a sponge, some clippers, and I cleaned off the plaque where she was buried. And I had a very tearful reading of that letter with my mom. And I go back every 6 months or so now to bring my mother up to date on what's going on in my life. And I want her to be proud of her son. You know, I want her to know that I'm sober and that the way that I am sober is a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, a worldwide society of people that wouldn't normally mix, but have taught me everything good in my life that's worth knowing. you know, there was a... famous director in my own group. He found out that I had been Taft-Hartley into the Screen Actors Guild by doing a golf commercial that was just a fluke, you know. I played golf with this guy, and he told me I should be making golf commercials. I said, I can't even smile to get my picture taken. How am I going to be, you know, I'm not an actor. I don't want to be an actor. I never cared to be an actor. He said, just let me send you out on some auditions, and we'll see what happens. And so he did, and I got a nationwide commercial that ran for a whole year. Then I got what, you know, being an actor was all about. You work for 3 days, you get paid for a whole year. Bingo. Residuals. But the reason I bring it up is because I got Taft-Hartley into SAG. So meanwhile... Life goes on. I'm doing all the other things that I'm doing. And then a guy calls me up and says, you know, I'm not doing operations for the guard service thing anymore. I'm the military advisor for a movie directed by that director that you were talking to. And he would like you to be in this movie. And not only that, you're a dead ringer for the guy that was head of the Secret Service during the Johnson administration. I said, would you like to see a picture of me when I was during the Johnson administration? He said, no, I don't. Do not show anybody that picture. Let's see what's wrong with hair down to here and eyes going around like that and reaching for a sidearm. Anyway, so I suited up and showed up, and I went to this thing, and we went to different locations every day in studios, and we shot these scenes. Everywhere the president went, I went. It was a movie made for HBO, and it was fun. It was like a master class in acting every day. I got to see big-time, big-name actors, you know, do their thing, you know, exercise their chops, and it was fun. One day we were going to shoot a scene at supposedly Tansanoot Air Force Base in Vietnam, but it was actually a little airport up the coast from where I live. So at 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm driving up the coast in the dark. I park in the parking lot of Channel Island State University and pile into a van along with all the other cast and crew. We go over to this airport. We shoot scenes at getting in and out of Air Force One of the three constellations left in the world that can still fly. It's a propeller-driven four-engine plane. Anyway, we're running in and out of this thing. It says United States of America on the side. And it was something I could do, you know, running in and out of the plane and get paid to do it. Then we pile back in the vans. We go back to Channel Island State University. And as we pull into the parking lot, I realize that this used to have a different name. It's now called, or it used to be called, Camarillo State Hospital. And I thought, For just a second, I thought, is this some kind of paranoid plot to get me back? No, can't be. But the caterer had set up in the old cafeteria, which they hadn't bothered to change one iota. The same paint job on it. That same inverted hull of a ship look, the striations on the ceiling, that sick, you know, institutional green. And I get my tray, and I'm thinking, wow, I can't believe it. And all of these scenes are running through my head about, you know, the food fights between the mentally ill and the mentally retarded, refereed by the substance abusers and the alcoholics. And, because I'll tell you, you know, once you're in the nut house, you know, you can act up all you want. Because what are they going to do? Throw you in the nut house? You're already there, baby. They can strap you down and fire you up with Thorazine, but who cares? You know, you're in the nut house. And so... a friend of mine is sitting across from me who knows my story, and I'm sitting down the table with his famous actors, and he said, "Man, you're being a little quiet today. What's going on?" And I said, "Don't worry, you know, no big deal. I'm just trying to get through this." And he said, "Oh, I know what it is. You've been here before." And so... it's not about stay sober 18, 20 years, you get to be in a movie. That's not what it's about. It's about you stay sober X amount of years, and for you, you will get to go to some place in your life that is a complete surprise and a complete shock and inspiration to your system, and you will realize that God is doing for you what you could not possibly do for yourself. That a circle is closing, one of many circles that will close in your life. And there is a, you know, going back to the nut house and being in a movie is just beyond the pale. You know, I'm going to tell you one more thing and I'll sit down. And so I don't do that anymore. I got a job 2 years ago in August of 07. And I was back in an office, the first time since 1989. Things had changed in an office since 1989. I played golf with the managing director of this company and the guy who put up 50% of the seed money to start up this digital media company. And I hit it off with these guys, and they decided to hire me based on the fact that I could play golf. You know, I'm going to be in an office now. And I'm back in the office, and in September of 07, I had the first of two major operations for advanced malignant melanoma. And they, you know, took a patch from my chest and put it on my head and cut me behind the ear and found out that it had spread to my lymph nodes. 21 days later, they cut me from here all the way down to here, took out all the lymph nodes on my right side. I had been under general anesthesia over 9 hours in 21 days. That leaves you feeling a little punchy when you head on back to work. You know, and I'm still figuring out what I'm supposed to be doing there. And so I get my swivel chair and I take it over to other people's desks and I say, you know, I'm not feeling too chipper today. Why don't you show me what it is you do and how you do it? And I'll just sit here and shut up. And I did that with everybody in my section. Some months later, I wasn't really very good at being back in an office again. I wasn't good at my job. The same two people that hired me took me back to the golf course in August of 08. And I thought, well, this is the blow-off, the final farewell. They said, you know, you may have noticed that we've had people coming in and out with MBAs, and we're interviewing for an office administrator and manager. You know, we hired a management consultant because we couldn't make up our minds. And he said, well, let me look around first. And I said, yeah, I know who you're talking about. I've talked to that guy a little bit. And he said, the management consultant came to us and said, you know, you have directors here, producers. You have computer people and digital media people. You've got a comedian that was on the Ed Sullivan show. You have a guy that was in a swing jazz band. You've got hip-hoppers and rappers. You got all of these diverse people. And I said, yeah, people that wouldn't normally mix, right? I said, yeah. And this management consultant said, you've already got a guy here that all these people like and get along with. And he seems to have a tremendous integrity. Where'd you find this guy? And they said, the golf course. You know. So I got, by the third hole, I'd been promoted to office administrator, and my salary was doubled, So I told a friend of mine about that, and he said, so you let them win at golf, right? And I said, no, they'd know I was a liar if I let that happen. So you don't know what's going to happen. You suit up and show up, and you know, you find a place where you're going to fit in, and it doesn't make any sense to anybody. It doesn't make any sense to me, but I'm there. You know, I'm there because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to do the next indicated right thing. I'm going to try to help people that come to me in my world that are going to hear from me, somebody that is trying to practice the principles in all their affairs. I know I'm in for it when people come into my office and they close the door behind me, behind them. You know, they're going to tell me something for which I may or may not have a solution, but at least I'm going to be there to hear it. And, you know, my life is different in every way worth talking about. I think I'm done for the night. I really thank you for listening, and I really love being here. Thanks a lot.